I had the pleasure of growing up a Kansan. I spent 10 years there, all of elementary and middle school, and it made a deep impression on me. The sports teams that I like are from there. Some of the American history that I find most fascinating happened there. And the best regional barbecue culture is located there in Kansas City, with the single best dish, beef burnt ends. As a schoolboy in Kansas, I drank deeply from the well of stories that Kansas, a place forged in opposition to slavery and the state of Missouri, tells about itself. On visits to the State House, I saw the famous mural of the abolitionist John Brown, Bible in one hand and rifle in the other, seemingly being torn in two by the wildness of bleeding Kansas. In elementary school, I went on a field trip to a one-room schoolhouse where the teacher leading the field trip decided she would be a martinet like they supposedly were back in the day, much to my chagrin. And on top of the Kansas State House sits a Native American hunter called Ad Astra, after the state motto, shooting a bow at the sky. Suffice to say, the mythos of this romanticized prairie sits lodged somewhere deep inside me. And central to that mythos lies the buffalo. Millions upon millions of them once roamed the plains, and they were, and still are, central to the cultures of Plains Indians. As we were told admiringly in school, Native Americans used all parts of the buffalo, and buffalo were also very important to indigenous religious rites. Prior to the arrival of the horse, Native Americans had a couple different ways for hunting buffalo, one of which is known as the buffalo jump. One hunter would act as a decoy and put on a buffalo pelt, while other hunters would surprise the herd and flush them in the direction of the decoy, who would then lead the herd, or as many as he could, off a cliff. Any buffalo that didn't die in the fall would then be killed by hunters, who would then harvest and process the animals. These hunts could be tremendously fruitful. That's the image that always comes to mind when I read the story of Legion from today's gospel. Read quickly, it's a fairly baffling story. Jesus heals a man who's possessed by a number of demons, which Jesus then allows to enter a large herd of pigs, who charge off of a hill and drown in a pond, to the dismay of the swineherds. Based on the context and the way the man addresses Jesus, we can understand the man to be a Gentile. The seemingly random deaths of a couple thousand pigs has always felt to me at odds with most of the other gospel stories. A story of seemingly incredible waste. It's just never made much sense to me. The historian Elaine Pagels writes that the story can only be understood in the context of the Roman occupation of Judea during and following the life of Jesus. Jews rebelled against Roman rule in 4 BC following the death of King Herod, leading to the arrival of a Roman legion who remained in occupied Judea for decades. Roman soldiers frequently acted badly, and their presence was widely hated throughout the region. Another Jewish rebellion broke out around 70 AD, which ended in the destruction of the Jerusalem temple and eventually led to another failed revolution 50 years later. Given this, Pagels writes that Jews of the time would have interpreted the liberation of the man and the destruction of the demons as foretelling the liberation of Israel through the Lord's removal of Roman soldiers from Judea, similar to the way that the Egyptian army perishes in the Red Sea while pursuing Moses and the fleeing people of Israel. Given this, the fact that the demons are named Legion makes a great deal more sense, even if to our modern eyes, this feels like a weird way to predict the liberation of an oppressed people. The historical background is helpful, but if we focus solely on it, we'll miss the other half of our story. Upon seeing Jesus, the possessed man cries, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" And there it is. What have you to do with me, Jesus? You can almost hear the uncertainty in this man's voice. Someone who's been driven to the margins of society by his possession, and whom we are told often sits shackled and chained while under guard. He has every reason to wonder why he would be approached by a traveling prophet. while the demons make clear their own dismay at Jesus' approach. I wonder if, in that moment, the man would prefer that Jesus just pass on by. But Jesus doesn't let the man shrink from him, nor does he care that the man is a Gentile. Instead, he speaks to the man and draws the demons out of him. And soon after, we read that the man, clothed in his right mind, is asking Jesus to let him tag along. Jesus rebuffs him, instead asking him to be, essentially, a missionary to his own people. By ministering to this Gentile, Jesus shows us that God's love is not limited to a select few. It's not limited to the people of Israel or to some other subset or in-group. It's a love that seeks us out the way Jesus seeked out the possessed man. A love that liberates and should be shared with all. It's a wild love that we aren't in control of, that flouts our human categories and overflows its bounds, even when we feel that we are not worthy recipients of it. This same theme of relationship to God is the topic of today's psalm, too. We read, "As the deer longs for the water brooks, so longs my soul for you, O God. My soul is athirst for God, athirst for the living God. When shall I come to appear before the presence of God?" The impatient desire of the psalmist for God rings out, both the hunger and the need. This is the other side of the coin from our gospel. Both put our relationship to God under the microscope, but act it out in different ways. Unlike the possessed man, the psalmist isn't afraid to be known by God, and isn't even afraid to be separated from God. Instead, they're being continually drawn towards God, come good or bad, relying upon their faith that God is listening. Even towards the end of the psalm, as the psalmist begins to list his misfortunes and seems broken, he closes with the command to put our trust in God, despite broken bones, oppression, mockery, maybe even demons. Put your trust in God. On some level, that's an easy thing to do, and on another level, it's much harder. A life of faith is a life spent reaching out towards God, and we restate that trust when we renew our baptismal vows. It's a life spent reaching out and feeling God waiting for you, and also reaching out and feeling nothing there. This is the ebb and flow of our psalm, and quite often it's the ebb and flow of our lives as well. This multifaceted relationship with God is expressed once more in Eucharistic Prayer C in our books of common prayer. Deliver us from the presumption of coming to this table only for solace only and not for strength, for pardon only and not for renewal. In ceding our need for certainty and to be in control to God, things that we're trained by our society to desire, we're empowered to live life as he's calling us to live it. We are empowered to keep reaching for God through good times and bad, and we are empowered to see God at work in the world around us, in places where it's easy and in places where it's very difficult. Much like the healing of the possessed man, God's desire to draw near to us and to know us, in spite of our failings, liberates us. Even if we may not always recognize that, we're invited by the psalmist to trust nonetheless in the God of my life. And sometimes that trust comes easy. And sometimes all we can do is ask, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" Amen.